Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Thank you very much for being here. And thank you particularly to the British Council, who have sponsored this session. They are one of our most valuable partners and have been key in developing the Hay Festival across the world. My name is Peter Florence, and if you'll forgive me one very short digression, because it is pertinent to my guest. This is my 50th Hay Festival that I have produced or directed around the world, and it is all down to Martin Amis in a really interesting way. It's wonderful, and one of the privileges of my job, that occasionally you get to talk to people who have not only been your heroes but have massively altered your life. And by accident, when I was a student, I never got to study anything but French and German. And in a swimming pool in 1985, whilst contributing negligently, considerably to the black economy of Colombia, I and a friend of mine came across a book. And I first read the words, "As my cab pulled off FDR Drive somewhere in the early hundreds, a low slung tomahawk full of black guys came sharking out of lane and sloped fast right across our bow," which is the opening sentence of Money. And from the moment that I first tasted those words, I was hooked on English literature. So please understand how wonderful it is for me, as well as for you, to be sitting here with Martin Amis, the author of those words. Martin, your novels, your journalism, your short stories, all above anything, lead us to language, to an amazing power, a versatility, a facility, a sheer relish and joy in the power of language. You mentioned yesterday in the session with John Updike, about John Updike's death, that John Cheever had categorize novelists into A-novelists, who are concerned with plot, character, psychoanalysis, or psychological development, and B-novelists, who are concerned with language. I assume that you are a B++ novelist.
First of all, let me digress and remember that question you were going to ask me.
I was. I'm going to come to it.
You're going to come to it. Well, the A novelist interested in plot forward development, the B novelist words lead a double life. They're all around us. They're on menus. They're how we do business. They're how we communicate with each other. But they have this other life, this secret life, on the page when used by what we call imaginative writers. And every writer knows that feeling of laying the words out and seeing the electricity of words and the connections they make towards each other and their sound and all the rest. So there is the B novelist. It was actually Anthony Burgess who made the distinction. And he considered himself a B novelist. I think the days of the B novelist are actually coming to an end. Joyce is the paradigmatic B novelist. Nabokov, you'd have to say, was B or B plus even. I would regard myself as sort of AB positive, combining, more and more interested, in fact, in social realism, in the immensely difficult task of just describing what actually happens when people interact. Perhaps not as interested as some writers in the little gradations of subtleties of how we behave with each other. But as you get older, you become more A. There's no choice. The electricity dies down, and the words, it seems a logical and proper thing that the words get a bit quieter. And social realism takes over, this strange genre called social realism. But I think it's like in other areas, the poetry is losing its hold on us because, and it's to do with history speeding up. The world, history is accelerating in the modern era. And what a poem does, a poem stops the clock. It says, you know, hold it, quiet, let's study this second, this moment, and this mood. And that is inimical to people, you know, all of us who are bowling, helter-skeltering forward with history. And also perhaps introspection, that stopping the clock and thinking about little moments, little epiphanies, is a little more unwelcome to us now.
Your engagement with history seems, in thinking about all your work, quite often extraordinarily prescient in that, for example, you were one of the first men to write interestingly from or with a female perspective about the sexual revolution. You were, you have been engaged with the big issues of the Cold War, of the threat of nuclear Armageddon. And you seem most recently to have been engaged particularly with Russia.
This is true. I used to pride myself on not being political. And I, in my 20s and 30s, I spent a lot of time with people of the far left, the poet James Fenton, the literary, the political man of letters, Christopher Hitchens. We were all in the same office. And I used to say to Christopher, you're interested in the wrong revolution, my friend. It's the sexual revolution that's the interesting one, and that's the one that's really happening. And your revolution against capitalism is not going to happen. You're wasting your time. And he would look at me with affectionate contempt and say, you know, you can't keep awake, can you? You know, look at him. He's off. He's smelt another one, you know, going by. And I said, yeah, I'm my interests are literature and girls. And you go and sell your socialist work on Kilburn High Street in the bloody rain, and I'll go and have my lunch with a young lady friend. But then it wasn't till towards the end of the century I started to get very interested in the Russian Revolution, which I still think is the most amazing rip in history that the world has ever seen. The horror and dynamism of the Russian experiment is thrilling to me. And I wrote a book on Stalin. And I think what I was doing was giving myself a political education, getting the terms, the precedents, the categories. And it's all very satisfying once you start, you know, looking into these subdivisions within political systems, etc. And I did it just in time because then came September the 11th. And I thought, in a way, this is my subject, because masculinity had always been my subject. That's what I've always written about, from the first novel to the most recent, is what it is to be a man. I try my very hardest to imagine what it is to be a woman, and I get as close to it as I'm capable of getting. But I do think I understand what goes on inside a man's mind, and here was, on September 11th, here was masculinity in an outlandish new outfit. And I do think that this very complicated phenomenon that really began perhaps with Ataturk in the early years of the 20th century and manifested itself so surprisingly. I mean, think how little we saw it coming. Think of the 1990s, the Clinton era, where we had so much time on our hands that we spent a whole year on Monica Lewinsky and another whole year on O.J. Simpson. And there was nothing to do, clearly. We had nothing on our minds. And then this great, what's turned into an enormous experiment in cruelty that began on that day with, you know, by Christmas of 2001, I was reading an unscandalized editorial in the Herald Tribune about the pros and cons of using torture. And I thought, that's a bit quick. And then Afghanistan happened, and then Iraq, which has been, it's quieter now, but was for a while a new kind of hell. An enormous control experiment in cruelty, to see how cruel the human being could be. One's understanding of all this is never done and never will be done, but I felt sort of more equipped to take it on, perhaps not in fiction. Fiction needs many years to filter down from the front brain to the back brain, down the spinal cord, and into your heart or your soul or whatever it is that fiction comes from. But I recognized it as a sort of new kind of crisis of masculinity, and still think that that's partly what it is.
Your most recently published novel, House of Meetings, covers some of the same territory as your nonfiction book, Cobra the Dread, and deals with the last 70 years of Russian history, from Soviet gulags to Beslan. How, when you're talking about the way that this time impacts upon the ability to write fiction, how does other literature impact upon that? How does the work of Solzhenitsyn inform your writing about the gulags in fiction terms?
Well, the Gulag Archipelago is the central text on that phenomenon, the gulag. But just to give an idea of how fiction works, for some historical atrocity of that kind, fiction is not much help to you. You want the facts, you want the history, and then this. I absorbed all that when I was writing about Stalin in the early years of the century, and then 5 years later, I found it. This process had taken place, where it goes down into you, and I had more to say. And the piece of information that made me write this novel about the Gulag was learning from Anne Applebaum's wonderful book, Gulag: A History, that there were facilities in the camps, even the most northerly, the most brutal, the most death-orientated camps, for conjugal visits. This meant that that fearless women would travel for weeks, sometimes months, across the length of the Soviet Union to spend a night with a husband. These meetings were nearly always tragic, partly because after a few months in the Gulag system, what happens is when you're starving, your body starts to eat itself. And in this kind of crisis for the body, the various male hormones are not produced. So at a very minimum, these nights in the House of Meetings, as it was called in all camps, would be a virtuoso display of impotence. That was your minimum. Very often, too, the woman was coming to say that the marriage was over, that the children were now being raised by the state. Even with the very best result, were loving time spent with the spouse. Returning from that house within the camp into the system and watching your wife walk away was almost worse than coming into the camp the first time. And the sentence that made me resolve to write this book was in a memoir by a Polish prisoner who said that after a visit from a wife, that prisoner would always be treated with the greatest respect and silence by all the other prisoners. And they would give him perhaps extra food, but they would always keep their distance. They wouldn't say anything to him. They would solemnly acknowledge what he was going through. But this marvelous human sensitivity in these surroundings of slave labor, which is what the Gulag was. People don't understand it. They say Guantanamo is the American Gulag. No, the Gulag was a slave empire within the Soviet Union. But in this terrible degradation and cruelty, there was still this respect for what had happened between a man and a woman. And it's moments like that that novels come from, not from reading another novel about the Gulag, which is more a kind of preemptive experience. You feel you're being overlapped on.
Can I just pick up on your earlier reference to your relationship with women? You mentioned recently in an interview that in the end you would think of yourself, judge yourself on how it had gone with the women. Now, I think on one level this might be taken to refer to the women that you were having lunch with when you were a young buck, equally your celebrity ex-girlfriends and your wives. But I assume from reading your remarkable memoir experience that equally, even in saying it, you are referring to your lately discovered daughter, Delilah, your sister, and your cousin, Lucy Partington, who was the victim of Fred West, a notorious British serial killer.
The fact that my sister died very young, at 46, and my cousin disappeared at the age of 20 and was not dug up for another 25 years, and the fact that I had a daughter of whose existence I had sort of guessed, but I said to my mother, I showed my mother a photograph of this little girl that I'd been sent by her mother, who in fact soon committed suicide. She was a manic depressive. And there was this very pretty little girl in a, you know, well-kept, in a middle-class household, and there she was. And I said, the mother says, I'm the father. And I said, what do you think, Mum? And I handed it to her. She snatched it out of my hand. She looked at it and she said, definitely. And then I said, what should I do? And she said, don't do anything, dear. It's not your place to do anything. And then 16 years later, the relationship began. And even now as I speak in my house in London, she's there. She's moved in while we're away, and she's looking after my smaller children as well as her own child. So I'm a grandfather top of everything else, and I can tell you that that's a mixed blessing. But no, I don't mean that. I mean, I think this is what you end up with on your deathbed, is thinking about how it went with women. I think this is the greatest test for a heterosexual man. I think this is what your life amounts to. That it's not your achievements, so-called, that you're thinking about. You're thinking about your cruelties, perhaps, your moments of kindness, perhaps, but all within that, how you behaved. Did you behave well? And I also very much, if you've been divorced, this will be one of the great matters that you have to work your way through as you're dying. The authority I have for this, I've always sort of suspected it was true. Saul Bellow, as he lay dying, I just know that he was thinking about his five marriages, his three children by different women. And a friend of his, who was the same age, but late 80s, went into Saul's bedroom and said, he said, I thought I'd be brisk, you know, because Saul was in and out of rational thought and had had Alzheimer's for years. And he went in and he said, well, Bellow, what are you going to say for yourself? And this man, who was unquestionably the greatest novelist of his generation, winner of the Nobel Prize and every other conceivable prize, translated into every language, etc., said, well, Gene, I was just thinking, what is it? Is it here goes a man or here goes a jerk? And Gene said, I think here goes a man. And he said, okay, I'll take your word for it. And what he was churning about was how it had gone with women. that's the measure of everything. I don't think women quite have to do this in the same way. It's not such. Women. It's always said that men are very slow to blame themselves for things, and that's true. And women perhaps are a bit quick to blame themselves for things. But that all flips towards the end. And the women, I think, break a habit of a lifetime and stop blaming themselves in that last stretch. And men break a habit of a lifetime and start blaming themselves. And number one on the agenda, number one on what Sorbella used to call the pain schedule, is always how it went with women. And that's all explored in the novel he wrote called More Die of Heartbreak, where at some point they're talking about deaths from a radiation, an atmospheric radiation phenomenon, and the character says, I think that's terrible, but I think in the end more die of heartbreak.
You talk of Saul Bullock, who we understand was a literary father to you and a great friend. You grew up, as you said, in a generation which included a cream of extraordinary writers from Oxford, including your friends McEwan and Rushdie and Barnes and Craig Raine. Your childhood was enriched by, and of course traumatized by, the relationship with your father, the novelist Kingsley.
No, let's get that straight. It wasn't at all traumatized. Because I've been asked about my father a lot, another novelist and poet, I've naturally talked about our differences. But it's become clear to me quite late on that it was an exceptionally smooth and loving relationship. And I assumed everyone had that with their father. But asking around, everyone had a terrible time with their father. The generational shift for my generation, the generational deal with the father was very sharp. And my theory for this, and this is perhaps jumping the gun on something we'll talk about a bit later, it was all to do with the sexual revolution. The sexual revolution was a revolution, and that's always a complicated event. But number one on the revolutionary manifesto of that time was, there will be sex before marriage. Everyone understood this very quickly. One's eyes lit up when you heard this. But think how it was for those for whom there had not been sex before marriage. In other words, the fathers, who were now looking around in dismay, saying, so you mean all that stuff about there being no sex before marriage? You're just going to cast that out, as if it had never been. And so then they turn to their sons, who are, say, 14, 15, and give them a terrible time without this ever being mentioned. It's all about, I think your hair's too long. But that was the subtext of it. And, of the friends we've mentioned tonight, Ian, Christopher Hitchens, James Fenton, all had a terrible time with their fathers because of this. Just to say that my relationship, my father wasn't going to do that because he'd had that fight with his father. And so on the contrary, you'd bring a girlfriend home when you were 15 in my house when I was growing up, and my father would say, if she wants to, she wants to spend the night, she'd be very welcome at breakfast. It was also sort of a bit too much the other way. But he thoroughly approved of promiscuity in the young. Thoroughly approved of it.
I apologize for preempting that. What I was going to ask was there ever a time in your life when language and literature was not going to be where you were?
No. In my pre-adolescent time. My theory is that when you're 12 or 13, and I can see my middle daughter entering this period, you start to keep diaries, you start to keep notebooks, you write poems perhaps, you maybe do a little sketch, you give your impressions of something. And something marvelous is actually beginning in you, and what this is communion with the self. It's as if you've located a second person within you who's very interested in your views and opinions, who wasn't there before. And suddenly you have this inner demon, good demon, that you begin having a relationship with, a heart-to-heart within yourself. And I think the writers are just the ones who never got over that, just went on doing it all their lives. It's, you know, everyone's a writer when they're 13, and then the more sensible among us start being interested in banking or insurance or taxi driving. But the writers are the ones who never did get over it. And I remember thinking, 13 or 14, I'm going to do this, and I'm in it for the long haul. I mean, the pattern of writers who are sons of writers, and John Updike's son David is a perfect example, is they write one book or a few short stories, and then they've done, that's it. They've solved the little urgency within themselves that had to do with filial rivalry. And they're fine, and that's the problem solved. For me, it was nothing to do with my father. It was, you know, maybe a bit, but the main thing was just this business of conjuring thoughts and words is what I want to do for the rest of my life. There was never any two ways about that.
You wrote once that you didn't want to write a sentence that could have been written by somebody else. How keenly do you still feel that? You said you've moved back towards being more A.
Well, I think, you know, in a longish novel, there are going to be a couple of sentences that anybody could have written. My father used to say, criticizing my, he said, there aren't enough of those sentences in your books. You know, he finished his drink and left. And I said, but in your books, there's too many of those sentences. I think it's a bit tiring where every sentence has to have something going for it. And maybe quietness is all a sentence needs going for it. I do believe in modulation. There's some kinds of writing where there is a compulsive vividness that every sentence has to be a poeticism of some kind or another. That's fine if you're a genius, but mere talent won't get you through that. That's Joyce. That's Nabokov. That's what Nicholson Baker calls the Prousto-Nabokovian level of creation. Not all of us are going to do that all the time or any of the time. So a little bit of relaxation of that rule has taken place.
After your second big golden period, you wrote a couple of books that were spectacularly inventive and experimental. I'm thinking particularly of Time's Arrow, which the conceit of which was that it was a life told backwards, and Night Train, which seems to me now, and I suspect to the writers of The Wire, an absolutely perfect reinvention of American police language and procedural. Do you look back on those books? A, do you look back on them at all? B, do you look back on them and now think, I wouldn't do that now, I wouldn't have done it given a second chance? Or are you secretly thrilled by the freedom that you had then to experiment?
I'll subsume that question, if I may, in another observation that actually you don't do any looking back at your work. This will be of interest to people in their mid-40s. In your mid-40s, your youth ends. You look in the mirror, and that voice that used to say, you know, it's funny this, but, you know, everyone else is getting older. But you're not. I don't know how you managed it, but, you know, keep it up, because it's a wonderful thing. You accept that mortality is out there somewhere, but in your case, you know, marvelous bit of luck, but it's not going to happen. Then there's one day around about 45, 46, when you look in the mirror and the jig is up. Then you have your midlife crisis, which is one of mortality, where you suddenly, it's a full-time job looking the other way. Death fills the sky. Then that quietens down and you have your, you know, you leave your wife, you buy a sports car, you have a 16-year-old girlfriend, you start doing press-ups, have an affair with your trainer, eat yogurt, you know, all that. The usual stuff. Then I'll tell you what, I'll warn you what happens next. In your late 40s, you suddenly start thinking, life seems very thin. And you suddenly start thinking, that went a bit quick. Or you may want to put it a little bit more emphatic and say, oh, you know, that went a bit fucking quick. You know, can't believe that this is what's happening to you. Then you pass 50, 51, 52, and suddenly there's an enormous new presence in your life, something that wasn't there before. Enormous presence. This is the past. And it's there like a city in your head where there was nothing before. And this marks the point at which the past is bigger than the future. And a corollary of that is that you don't want to go back in your work at all. It's agony for me to look at my early writing because I have this abbreviating future. I think very much about the past emotionally and very much about past experiences with women. This is a huge thing, but not about the work. It's a torment even to correct the proofs of the book you finished 6 months ago. It becomes more and more onerous to you know, go on the road, promote the book you wrote 6 months ago. You're a hireling of a previous self, slave of a previous self. It's absolutely onward from now on with the work. There's no going back.
Does it get any easier?
Working.
Yeah.
It does, because you begin to realize certain things about writing that, you know, I teach writing, creative writing, and when I say this sort of thing to my class, I say, but, you know, don't take this too literally, because you have to go through what I went through. For instance, if you're 25 and you're writing a novel and you come up to a really difficult, a critical stage in this novel, sort of say a third of the way through, something's wrong. You don't know what it is. But you know that this next scene you're trying to write is not coming at all. It's dead. You haven't been able to breathe life into it. Maybe that actually you've turned down the wrong avenue. Something's wrong. And if you're 25, you just sit there in your desk and you bang your head against this wall. You tear your hair out. You hammer your fists against it. And perhaps you get through it after, you know, a week of torment. Now when this happens, you find your feet take you away from your desk. You don't stay at your desk. You don't want to be at your desk. You just go and sit in an armchair and you read. And then it may be an hour later, it may be a day, 3 days later, your feet bring you back to the desk and you're ready. And you haven't given it a thought, but it's fixed. Because you're humoring your own unconscious. You know how to deal. Your unconscious is like an impossible elderly relative or child that you have to deal with. But now you know how to do it. You just ignore it for a few days, and then it fixes itself. Writing is a more physical activity than we perhaps suspect. And I love it, the fact that Zorbello used to sweat when he wrote, as if doing hard work, you know, hard manual labor, he would, and very hot and stimulated. It is physical.
When you say it's physical, I'm fascinated to know, given the savoring of language that still informs all your work, whether it's also an oral experience. Do you mouth these words? Do they come to you as sounds and then get transcribed?
Yeah, I mean, I often say it out loud as I'm typing it. You can't really define what it is, but it's going at the sentence again and again until it's still in your mind, until there's nothing jangling about it. It's like a tuning fork that has an annoying vibration, and when that tuning fork is still, then the sentence is finished. So it's that kind of process.
And that happens up here before it happens before you type it?
No. You can... Well, the computer, you know, tempts you into this a bit, that you think, I'll type it out and then fix it, rather than fixing it on the page, where I nearly always write it out in longhand. There's something about the flow of blood and ink that feels... reassuring and natural. There were several books written when the computer started being used by writers, called things like Catastrophe, : The Effect of the Computer on Modern Prose. And people were arguing that no sentence will ever have the finality and justice that it deserves because you can always fix it. Well, yes, but that's, you have to fix it anyway. It's just a question of when you fix it. It's better to fix it on the page, and then typing becomes more mechanical. But there's not a writer on earth who doesn't make changes while you type.
Does your subject matter come to you in the same subconscious way? Something happens, and then 5-10 years later, it demands to be written out. And what are you doing now?
I'm writing a novel set in 1970 about the sexual revolution.
No.
Yeah. It's called The Pregnant Widow. There is no pregnant widow in it. There are just a lot of young people trying to find their feet as the tectonic plates of the moral world shift. The phrase comes from a marvelous couple of sentences by the Russian thinker Alexander Herzen, which goes something like this. The dissolution of the old forms, he's talking about revolutions, social, cultural, political. The dissolution of the old forms should give joy to the soul and not trouble it. But what is frightening is that as the old world gives away, what it leaves behind it is not an heir, not an inheritor, not a child, but a pregnant widow. And between the death of the one and the birth of the other, a long night of chaos and desolation will follow. And I believe that the sexual revolution is now in perhaps its second trimester. This pregnancy is very long. As in all revolutions. And it was actually quite a complicated thing. The sexual revolution was asking us, I mean, for all its obvious attractions, it was saying there will be sex before marriage. It was saying there will be much more concentration on surface, that surfaces will actually become more important than essences, not well understood at the time at all. There were other sub-clauses, but perhaps the main one, and I'll make a literary comparison. In the 17th century, it was said that there was something called a dissociation of sensibility. This meant that until this dissociation happened, the poets of that era, 17th century, including Shakespeare, could think and feel at the same time. There was a oneness of sensibility that then dissolved. And poets could no longer quite do that. And Romanticism was a reaction. Then you have the Augustan age in English poetry with Dryden and Pope, neoclassical. Then you have the Romantics trying to regain this instinctive unity of thought and feeling. Now, what the sexual revolution asked us to separate was sex and emotion, which had always been, you know, there'd always been emotionless sex, of course, as, you know, through, you know, immemorial times. But the connection was always there, and emotionless sex was illicit sex, was paid sex, was, you know, demi-monde sex. But now everyone was being asked to make the separation. And also with that came a further sense that the removal of sex from the idea of reproduction, as if they'd never had anything to do with each other, as if everyone knew that the way you had children was by sneezing at someone, nothing to do with sex. It became a play of surfaces. And in pornography, we see the industrialization of that split. Now, in my own experience, there were people who came through the revolution. As in all revolutions, there are those who adapt very quickly, who sense the way it's turning. Not always the nicest people, but the most, whose antennae are the most sensitive to the new balances. And there are people who completely overdo it. You know, in 1970, the idea was that women should act like men. That once they started to do that, everything would be fine. And it was a very good time to be a man, but it took several years before women realized that it was not in their interest to behave like a man, that it went against their evolutionary being, that girls could not act like men, that they would not enjoy it, they would not benefit from it. And some of them were damaged for life. And there were all sorts of new ways of failing and falling, and it's in that side of it that you know, that's my emphasis. My sister was a spectacular victim. It was a velvet revolution in many senses, including the literal one, but it was not a bloodless revolution.
You must presumably, however you feel about revisiting earlier work, have re-encountered the Rachel papers, which contributed to that era considerably.
Well, I had to look at it again, which I hate to do, simply to try and remember what it was like to be 21. And youth, you know, which we look back on as we should with love and respect, but we should not forget that it is a freakish state, youth. It's for a long time you're pretending to know things that you don't. It's a very jittery state. You know, that's what's wonderful about it, but it's certainly not how you should be feeling at 60. It's something that, you know, I always think that they say old age is not for sissies. Actually, the truth is that old age is not for old people. Old age, you really need to be at the top of your form, you know, not just young, but fit, and of sterling character and all the rest. It's said that youth is wasted on the young, and I've written a novel backwards in time, but that was where, you know, the film just turned around and drifted backwards. But imagine if life went the other way, where, you know, you're a reeking old wreck for 10 or 15 years, then suddenly you start having, you know, your wife and, you know, your girlfriends are getting younger, and you're getting younger, and not everything hurts all the time. And then suddenly you're middle-aged, and all this is improving very fast now, and then suddenly you're 35. And imagine coming to 35, coming to youth, knowing all you know at 35. And then you have this extravagant time until you're pre-adolescent. And then you fade away and you become slightly crazy, stupid, but you're a fragrant and adorable creature rather than the opposite of those. And then you beautifully meld into your mother, and that's the end. And you know when it's going to happen.
Martin, can I ask you one last question before opening this to the floor?
No, don't forget that.
This is it.
Yeah.
Sorry, we rehearsed this and I blew it. Martin, have you been to Colombia before?
I have. I'll tell the story. I was living in Uruguay, and I agreed to come to Bogota with Médicos Sin Fronteras, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, on a dangerous mission. But on the way, I went to Cuba and spent a fruitless 8 days trying to track down Diego Maradona. To write about him. It was ridiculous. We were doing it for The Guardian. It was to promote his autobiography. And he wouldn't see us. And so we did eventually get a meeting with his financial advisor. I'm sure it wasn't the one who bankrupted him a few years earlier by making him buy a string of Peruvian bingo halls, who kept saying, we want to talk to Diego. And he said, por qué? And we said to promote his autobiography, give him publicity, long piece in The Guardian about him. He said, sí, pero ¿por qué? Meaning he wanted £10,000 to arrange the interview. So nothing happened, and occasionally we'd get up in the middle of the night and drive to the airport because there was a rumor that Diego would be waddling through at 2 or 3 in the morning. Anyway, nothing happened, and I wrote what amounted to a long review of his autobiography. Very exhausting, you know, not having the material and not having seen him. And I spent a very long day writing this piece. Then I looked, before going to bed, I looked at my ticket, my first-class ticket to Bogota. So I was intending to arrive with some pomp in Bogota. And I looked at the ticket. I thought, oh, that's funny. I thought it was an early flight, but it's not so early after all. Then I knew something was wrong when my breakfast arrived at 8 o'clock. This is in Havana. I'd ordered 2 7-minute eggs for breakfast, and I got 7 2-minute eggs. And I opened one of them, and it spilled all over the place. And I knew something had gone wrong with time. But as I finished my breakfast, ate what I could, and was having a cigarette, and then looked again at my ticket. Now, the night before, I'd looked at it, and it said, plainly enough, 10.00. And I thought, oh, 1 o'clock. Yeah, that's not bad. I thought it was earlier than that. I looked at my watch. It was 8:45. I threw everything I had into my suitcase, ran downstairs, checked out, which takes some doing in Cuba because you can't do it with anything that goes through America, leapt into a taxi drive car while still having time to hear someone saying, hello, my friend. and someone else saying, give me some money, Mike. I ain't got fucking nothing. Jumped into the taxi, said, take me to the airport as quickly as you can. And he turned around and said, quickly as I can't drive quickly. This is Cuba. I can't drive quickly. You know, I'd go to prison if I drive quickly. In Carcel, he said. So we went, 15 miles an hour to the airport. I arrived just as the plane was lifting off. I had to be in Bogota that day, meeting my wife, this whole project with the Médicos Sin Fronteras, all depended on me getting there. I said, when's the next plane? They said, a week today. So I staggered around in these offices downstairs saying, por favor, and managed to get a flight going through Panama City in a few hours. So I went back to the hotel. The maids were still laughing sort of clutching each other, laughing. They'd never seen anyone leave so many clothes behind. The whole drawerfuls, closets full. So I spent the last of my money going back to the airport. Arrived Bogota. It wasn't like earlier. It was 2003. Not like earlier times where you'd arrive and be a curfew and two taxis at the airport. It wasn't like that, but Bogota, a notoriously risky place. Arrived at 1 o'clock in the morning with no money, not even a telephone number, no idea where I was supposed to go. Anyway, it was all right. I was met by the doctors, and then the next morning we flew to Cali, and I spent a very relaxing week interviewing crippled murderers. I repeat, crippled murderers. These were all terrifying men who had been shot in the spine for venganzas. So they were impotent and crippled. And it was an extraordinary experience to lie talking to a succession of these men. Men who, you know, very frightening men would have been very frightened of these men. And yet here they were completely gone, absolutely rubbed out, erased, humiliated. And every morning at the hospital, there was a traffic jam of these murderers in their wheelchairs. And if they'd had horns to blast and lights to flash, they would have been all shouting at each other. And there was Cali, the worst slums. You know, Cali at that point was more violent than Baghdad, more murders per day than Baghdad. And we went to the worst slums, talked to the gangs, talked to this success, you know, saw people. They didn't shut up their shops at night. They shut up their houses. Imagine whole encaged houses, that tugging them down, metal shutters, looked like prison bars over every house in this neighborhood. Talking to little boys being shot in the head by stray bullets. Absolute, totally lawless part of town. Then that was Cali, and this is Cartagena. Land of contrasts, I think, as they say in the travel brochures, because here is an elegant paradise. With, it has to be said, you know, not too far away, again, this seething other half of this extraordinary country, which is, you know, stands fair and square on the equator, with its shoulders, you know, one in the Atlantic, one in the Pacific. What an extraordinary country it is. And thank you for having me back.
We have 10 minutes or so for questions from the audience. If anybody would like to ask a question, could they put up their hand, please? Yeah, the first one from a gentleman down here. The microphones tend to work best if you hold them 2 or 3 centimeters away from your mouth. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for being here in Cartagena. Two questions, if you please. The first one, did you write about this experience in Cali? And if did you, which one of your books? And the second one, I didn't get it. When you were speaking about the transition between OJ, Monica Lewinsky, and torture, because somehow you were speaking about this sexual revolution or crisis in masculinity. Will you please readdress that point?
Sorry, I didn't understand.
Sorry, could you just say that again?
If you say the first question, and then we'll do the second question.
All right, thank you. The first question, when you were talking about Cali and your experience. Did you write something about that? And did you where?
Will I write something about it?
Did you already write?
Did you already write? I think.
I did write a long piece about Cali. And it ended, I thought it ended rather well, in that there was these descriptions of these terrible events. And on the last day, we went to a funeral. And it was of a young woman, sister of one of the people we were working with, who died, you know, quite innocently of illness. And there was the mother absolutely inconsolably weeping, and there was the husband also inconsolable. And I suddenly realized what had happened to me in the 8 or 9 days I was in Cali, where I persuaded myself that the value of life was lower than I had imagined. That in fact life wasn't as valuable as I'd believed when I arrived. And here at this funeral, I was presented with a bill for this experience, where the sudden sight of terrible grief reasserted the value of human life, and was profoundly shocking to me, to have it laid before me, the true value of life. So yes, I did write about it in the Sunday Times. I'm sure you can get it online if you just key it in.
Thank you. And the second one, will you please elaborate a little bit more when you were talking about the transition between Monica Lewinsky and torture?
You're saying about Monica Lewinsky?
And torture. That we were just living just there, and suddenly we changed the subject.
I'm really sorry. I don't quite follow that question. Is there a question from somebody else further back? Yeah, over there.
You mentioned that you feel we have less taste for these little epiphanies of poetry, and you talk about the sense of history speeding up, but I wonder if that's maybe related to the points that you make about aging, that as we grow older, perhaps we feel time accelerating, so that we have less patience for things that make time stand still. I wonder if you could elaborate a bit on that. Your father was a poet, I know. Also had a very close relationship to Philip Larkin, whose letters I enjoyed reading last year. But you write with a very poetic touch, and I wonder also where you stand on your own poetry, whether that's still maybe an ambition of yours at all.
About writing poetry?
Yes.
There's a my father was a poet as well as a novelist, and he always regarded it as the higher calling, and I always agreed, and I think I still do, that in the hierarchy, literature, despite what everyone says about everything being equal, is based on hierarchies and stratifications. And at the top, you get poetry. At the top of poetry, you get epic poetry. But anyway, there's poetry. There, a little bit further down, in my view, is the novel. Then an enormous drop, and there's the drama. And it's just a cosmic joke that Shakespeare was a dramatist. If you take Shakespeare away, what have you got? Nothing. You've got a sepulchral old Norwegian called Ibsen. And that's it.
You've got Aeschylus,
you've got it, the ancients.
Yes. Well, they were good.
They were very good indeed. But the difference between the novelist and the poet is one caught very well by Auden's sonnet called The Novelist. And he says, you know, he describes the poet encased in talent like a uniform. You know, the poet, they can dash forward like hussars. And he says it's the novelist's task to be boring with the boring, with the filthy, be filthy too, absorbing in your whole being, you know, the slower work of man. That's not an exact quote. But in my view, the reactions of the novelist are absolutely average. If you ask me how I felt on September the 12th, 2001, I'll tell you, and I'm pretty sure that everyone in this theater would agree with it. That's what the novelist is. The median, the norm, the average. In, you know, what you do with those feelings is different. Whereas the poet, a much more freakish kind of response, where the poet doesn't feel as the masses do, as we all do. It's a completely different sort of response. So I did write poems when I was young, and I even published two poems in my 20s. And Larkin was my father's best friend, in that Larkin had a best friend. And I saw something of him when I was a child and later on. But you just find out which you are. And that's perhaps the line on which it divides. Are your feelings very individual, or are they universal? Is the nicest way of putting it. And that's what you find out about yourself.
We have time for one last question. Could I, with apologies to the people upstairs, take it from the guy back there?
Hi, good afternoon. I have more a comment than a question. First of all, thank you very much for your intervention. And secondly, I'm from the city of Cali, and I think that your statement was quite unfair. Cali has never reached the violence rates of Baghdad, fortunately, although we have been hit very hard by the terrorism and the drug dealers here. And I think it's very sad that you have such an image of one of the most fascinating cities of this fascinating country. So I invite you, actually, to come back to Cali so you can take a second look at it.
I'd love to come back. No, and thank you for sticking up for Cali. It's actually, it's not true. But Baghdad soon outsoared Cali. But the time we were there, there were more murders per day in Cali than in Baghdad. And here's an interesting little detail I happen to know. That the day of the week favored for the murderer is Sunday. And actually, you don't have to think about it very long before you realize that that's the day when you can get people, you can catch people at home. But Cali was, of course, many other things. There was a perfectly recognizable city in the middle of all this, and the boundary was marked, again, with marvelous, colorful symbolism by jugglers. And they weren't juggling ordinary jugglers' clubs. They were juggling shaped pieces of burning tar. And this was welcome to the barrio. Of course, I thirst to go back to Cali.
Martin, thank you very much. He will be able to take more questions while he's signing afterwards. Thank you very much for being here, and please join me in thanking Martin Amis.